So
I'm just going to continue the sort of the summary that we had going. And last time I really went through all the various sort of cosmology, basically, and the evidence for inflation and how it is that it's really not brightening up very much, is it? Okay. Well,
maybe they'll fix it over the summer.
Maybe. Maybe. I mean, it's been getting slowly worse in the last month. There's been some issue going on, and now it's basically just completely not functional. Which I suppose that I realized I could deal with. Well, okay, so we'll see if either of those manage to do anything. Pretend you see the cosmic landscape here. Yeah, so we have this idea of, we know we have the expanding universe, and then from that you come up with a model of the Big Bang, and then if you have the model of the Big Bang, then you have certain implications for phase transitions, and you want to see the cosmic microwave background. You have predictions for what the light nuclei should be in the primordial universe, and then when you go look, you find these things, so this is really fabulous evidence for the Big Bang. But the Big Bang itself has fundamental issues in that the light cosmic microwave background coming from here and here were causally disconnected at the time that they were emitted. Lots of other issues like, and yet they have the same temperature. And a number of other issues fundamentally tell you that the Big Bang in and of itself cannot possibly be right. And so they come with this crazy idea that you start with something very small and 10 to the minus 35 seconds after the Big Bang, it blows up to something quite big relative to the size of the observable universe. And this manages to fix all the problems. So, for example, regardless of what the curvature of the space-time geometry is at the very start, when you stretch it out to be very large relative to the observable universe, that geometry is going to look flat. So that is a natural explanation as to why the universe is flat. It also tells you that at one early stage you did have a causal connection between the part of the universe that emitted the cosmic microwave background this way and that way. So you should, in fact, find that they are very close to the same temperature. Then if you look very much closer at the cosmic microwave background, you actually also see evidence that it's not completely uniform in its temperature, that there are small fluctuations, and those fluctuations correspond to the energy non-uniformities that led to the gravitational collapse that turned into the galactic clusters and things that we see today. And those non-uniformities come from the quantum fluctuations in energy that you have at a very small scale that get blown up cosmic scale in inflation. And you actually can see that the pattern of the sizes and frequencies of those fluctuations agrees with what you would expect from this kind of quantum mechanical expansion. So there's a strange idea of inflation, and if you look and you do a very careful analysis of the sizes and frequencies of all these different color spots on the cosmic microwave background, different small regions that vary in temperature by 1 part and 10 to the fifth, then you find that it is consistent with a model where you have inflation, but it also requires the addition of dark matter, which we talked about, and dark energy, which is whatever it is that's causing the accelerating expansion of the universe. So when you add all of those components together, you end up getting something that very well describes what's called the power spectrum of the early universe. That is, it looks at the frequency of the different size temperature fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background, which would then correspond in the early universe to regions of density perturbation. That's how it ties into dark matter, for example. So if I have a high dense region and it's all matter, there'll be pressure that will cause it to evolve. So by the time the cosmic microwave background is released, the size will be different than it would be if much of that matter were dark matter, which basically can exert no pressure on it. So by looking at basically these sound waves in the early universe, how these density perturbations change, which you see as slightly different colors in the cosmic microwave background, you are sensitive to how much the universe expands with time. So that is, what is the expansion rate of the universe and the fact that it's accelerating, so how much dark energy you have. You are sensitive to how much cold dark matter you have, sort of by the reasons I just told you, and you're sensitive to how much matter you have. And it turns out that if we have a model that contains all of these components, you can fit the data, this power spectrum, very well. So that is actually evidence for inflation, in the sense that it requires inflation to make it work. The whole Big Bang model only holds together if you have inflation. So that is, to some extent, evidence for inflation. But then there are these recent measurements from the BICEP collaboration where they look at the interactions between the light that's in the early universe with the actual propagating gravitational waves that you get when you take the distorted space-time from the early pre-inflation universe and blow it up to large scales, and you would actually expect to see primordial gravitational waves propagating. And gravitational waves have some characteristics which will cause adjustments in the orientation, will affect the orientation of the electric field and the light that's coming to us in the cosmic microwave background in such a way that on certain size scales, when you look at it, you can see how that polarization changes in a very characteristic way. And so that's recently been observed, and it's very, very strong evidence for inflation and, in fact, for quantum gravity and gravitational waves, too. So it's a pretty big deal. If it holds up, my guess is it's going to yield a Nobel Prize for the people who predicted inflation, and it will also yield probably a Nobel Prize for the people who saw these BMOD oscillations, as they call them, recently, this BICEP collaboration. We'll see if it holds up. The signal they see is a little stronger than you might expect, so not so sure about that. But then if you have inflation, you have this idea that you start out with something very small and you blow it up to be vastly larger than the observable universe. So you clearly, under that case, have a multiverse which is formed by having regions of the reality that's similar to our reality, which is well outside what we'll ever be causally connected to. And so that would be Tegmark's type 1 multiverse. And then if you have inflation happening, we have no idea how to stop it except with quantum fluctuations in the structure of the space-time as it's expanding. And if that happens, you might expect it to happen differently in different places, and this is the idea of the formation of the bubble multiverse, where within each of these bubbles, you could have something that's not so different from what our Big Bang was, but the physical constants may be very different because the quantum fluctuation that may have caused the inflation to slow down at that point could, in fact, be rather different from what caused ours. There may be 10 to the 500 different ways in which you can rearrange the six dimensions of space that we do not observe and compactify them so that we don't observe them. There are about 10 to the 500 different ways of doing that. Each way in which you do that imbues the vacuum of space where that is with a certain potential energy, and that's the term that drives the expansion and the Einstein's general relativity equation. So that's sort of what controls how much we're expanding, whether you have inflation or whether you collapse and things like that. So if we have all these different ways of arranging those extra dimensions, then you might expect to have a big range of possibilities in terms of what a universe could be, in terms of how its physical constants manifest themselves. And in a bubble multiverse, since basically you have this forever expanding inflation with regions where you may form different universes, and within them they may have quantum fluctuations from local minima to other minima, you might expect to populate all 10 to the 500 different types. So this is a way in which you can argue that even though our universe seems to be finely tuned, you might expect to see it in the sense that we would find ourselves, if everything that's possible exists out there, we'll find ourselves in one that is conducive to us being there to see it. So those are cosmological multiverses, and I talk a lot about those because in some sense I think the case for those is actually fairly compelling. Whether you actually have a multiverse or not is hardly a scientific question because of the way we've defined it. You can't really step outside the region in which you can ever possibly be causally connected to and make an observation. So it almost is a religious question at that point. Maybe it is just philosophy and religion. I don't mean that in a demeaning way. It's just it takes it out of the realm of being able to make direct scientific measurements. But it is a little bit different from just making up something because these different multiverses, the cosmological ones, are inferred from scientific theory that actually does have a lot of evidence supporting it. Right? So if you believe in inflation, these things follow from it, and inflation we have some evidence for. We just can't step outside and prove one case or the other. At least nobody's figured out how to do that. So we also talk about other multiverses. The main one people talk about is the many worlds multiverse in quantum mechanics. And the way in which that works, just to remind you, in quantum mechanics we cannot measure, there are limits to how well we can measure things. And what quantum mechanics predicts is probability distributions. And then, so any quantum mechanical event that happens, you may have a probability distribution which you can understand, and if you do a million measurements, you'll see that it fits the probability distribution exactly. But for any given process, any given individual quantum event, you have no idea which value it's going to take. You may know the envelope in which you'll find it, but you'll never know exactly where it happens. So an example might be if you have light passing through two slits, and then the light from this slit and the light from this slit might interfere as it hits a screen back here, and it will give you a series of bright fringes. So we've seen that before. So if I look at the probability of where a photon might hit, it will peak at each of these fringes. But for any individual photon coming through, you have no idea where it's going to hit. All you know is this probability distribution that you may see. So the problem, so in quantum mechanics, you have to preserve this probability that photon could be anywhere along there, or this quantum process could have all of its possibilities, up until the exact moment that whatever it is happens, or a measurement is made. So the minute the photon comes down and interacts with the film or the screen, and you can observe it, then you know 100% probability of where the photon is, and the mathematical function that describes it, as we call the wave function, changes from something that has this finite extent into something that basically peaks and has a probability of 1 at just that point for whatever that process was. And that collapse has to be instantaneous, which bothers a lot of people. Okay, it's the whole idea of things being instantaneous in that way doesn't seem quite right. So see if I can do something about this for a second. Turn them off. Try to turn them on in a second. So that whole idea of how to make quantum mechanical calculations works very well in the laboratory. And so it has a lot of scientific validity in that sense. And people get around this idea that they don't worry so much about this instantaneous collapse because what you measure is not the actual mathematical wave function. You measure the event happening, and those really are two different things. So they're not too worried about it. Since you're not able to sample the actual wave function that is doing the collapsing, they argue, well, why should you worry about it? So the spirit of that, it's sort of summed up by the sentence, so, you know, just shut up and calculate is what you think. So that point of view is called the Copenhagen point of view in quantum mechanics. Another way of looking at it, which yields exactly the same calculations, but has a slightly stranger way of looking at the universe, is one where you assume that this process is not isolated. That, in fact, you have a wave function that describes the entire universe, and this wave function has, we say it's unitary. What that means is that probability is preserved within this entire wave function. And then you have mathematically, every time you have a quantum process, all of the possibilities progress in that wave function. So you don't collapse the wave function, you simply allow all possibilities to happen. And, you know, if you have half a probability for this one to happen and a half a probability for that one to happen, within the overall wave function, you have a probability of 1, and it allows this to happen half the time and that to happen half the time, whatever it is. And the reason that we can't observe both things happening at the same time is because within the mathematical description of quantum mechanics, it's effectively an infinite dimensional space of all the different dimensions and spins and things that can happen. And basically, you're sort of confined to be in the region of space where you share that dimensionality. But if you are looking at a quantum process, it necessarily splits into different dimensionalities. And so, effectively, if you're within one of these, you can't see the other. But this leads to this strange mental idea that every time you have a quantum process, you have this splitting into different dimensionalities that sort of happens. So the picture people get is, you know, you take a particular example. So we have a particle that may have a 50% chance of decaying one way and 50% chance of decaying the other way or something. And when it decays, then sort of you imagine having the universe split into two within this great reality. And in one case, it went this way, and in one case, it went that way. Nothing collapsed, so that gets around that problem. But at the cost of sort of creating these different threads of reality, which people call many worlds. And so this is the multiple universe that you will see more often in television shows and things like that. The idea of having these different dimensions of reality, which, I mean, we share the same three states, which is separated in different ways. So when somebody comes and they ask you if ghosts are bleeding in from other dimensions, that's really what they mean, as I've found out when I've been interviewing for radio shows on this. It's like, seriously? I never thought about that. So, but that turns out to be what a lot of people think. At any rate, so the thing about this many worlds idea, it can raise some rather strange complications, because the sheer number of quantum mechanical processes that are happening at any given time is just completely mind-boggling. So to imagine that all of that happens at once and continued, I don't know how you really get your head around that. Another way to think about it is it's a mistake to think of it as splitting into finite threads. Because if you imagine having this one nucleus decay this way or that way, the entire rest of the universe is unchanged at that very instant that you have this decay happen, if you want to think about it that way. And so then you have the reality sort of going on its own way, and within each reality, everything is going independently. So what you end up with is basically this continuous cosm of very slightly different realities, maybe. It's a way to think about it. So it's not so much that you just have a this thread or that thread. I think you end up imagining reality to be more of a continuum of these quantum possibilities at any given time. And basically, the rest of the universe won't notice this nucleus go that way or this way. So it all seems the same to everything that's out there. And so that sort of is going to be true for most of the things that happen. If we wait 50 years with all the different independent quantum processes that would happen in each thread, then what progresses out of one thread and what progresses out of the other thread, most of the threads would look very different at that point. But very close to the time when that event happens, I think you're going to see basically the realities look very, very similar. So it's a strange world. It is also something that, because quantum mechanics is very well supported scientifically and experimentally, it's one that you may want to take seriously. I call it a scientifically inferred multiple universe. Nobody's going to argue that we really, really understand everything about quantum mechanics. So this is a way of looking at quantum mechanics, and I've learned enough about it to realize that the formulation of it is actually more elegant. It's a bit, the mathematical formulation of it is nicer, if you will, than the formulation where you have a wave function that has its instantaneous collapse. And so that becomes more of an aesthetic thing as to whether you want to believe in it or not. But the implications are a little bit weird either way in quantum mechanics. And my guess is over the years it's an active area of research, so people are worrying about that. We talked about some other multiverse ideas, some of which are a little wackier than others. One of my favorites is the computational multiverse. The idea being that if you are able to create artificial intelligence or to create artificially intelligent beings within simulations, which some people believe maybe we're not so far off from being able to do. But if you were able to do that, then if you could, in essence, create a simulation of a universe that had within it simulated sentient beings, which people doing this writing call them sims, then one of your essays, we were talking about this one, said in the essay, I can't imagine that people would actually do this. Why would they do it? And I actually think that's completely I actually strongly disagree with that particular point. I know lots of people that if they had the ability to simulate a universe, they would totally go hog wild, right? Because they would have so much fun. Let's simulate this universe and let's tweak this constant a little bit and see what happens. Let's do this a little bit. And if you could change the parameters in your sim, you would a little bit. Do you know a psychology major that wouldn't have a lot of fun with that? Right? So I think, me and lots of the people I know would have a whole lot of fun doing it. So the idea is, if you were able to create such a simulation, you would. And then if you had sims within a simulation, and they developed the technology within the simulation to have sims and create a universe and computational universe, then they would. And so the thought is that under such circumstances, you might have a sort of exponential growth in the number of computational multiverses, and therefore, if this is technically possible, and civilizations do not kill themselves off before they develop that capability, then the probability is that we are in a simulation, because all the universes out there at that point, with the vast number of them, would be simulated, because you've got simulations and then simulations and then simulations. Pretty out there. I don't know how compelling that one is, but I find it entertaining. There is one type of multiverse which at least Lee Smolin claims is scientific, and this is one where he asks what happens inside of black holes. So if you have a collapsing star, it's collapsing into a black hole. If you were able, which you're not, but if you were able to ride the space into the black hole, you would sort of see yourself going into the black hole. In principle, you get a singularity in the black hole, and we don't really know what happens there, because when you get to a singularity, you have such a huge energy density, and the curvature has to be so dramatic that basically you can't think about what happens without invoking quantum gravity, and we don't have a working theory of quantum gravity. However, Lee Smolin plays with ideas that are sort of models of quantum gravity. They don't really seem, they're hypothetical models of quantum gravity. And from the outside, what happens is as the space collapses in, you have such a large gravitational field that the light can't escape. That is, you have distorted space in such a way that light just goes in a circle. And once you reach that point, that part of the universe becomes causally disconnected from us. So it basically is removed from how we've defined our universe. So there is a reality that's inside that black hole that is no longer and will never be causally connected to our universe again. So Lee Smolin has this pretty crazy idea where the space inside the black hole collapses and then rebounds. And he does this rebound through some, it's a little bit of a suppose it happens sort of thing through the quantum gravity. What he claims is that as the space sort of does this bounce, you now have within the black hole an expanding space-time, and you can get a solution that makes it look just like what we see in an expanding universe. And it is now causally disconnected from the universe that gave birth to it, if you want to think of it that way. So you can have a solution where now you have the expanding space-time inside this black hole. So it's a little bit like it may feel a little bit like a ship in a bottle, but relatively sort of weird stuff. So you can have this expanding universe within the black hole. And what he argues is that whatever the configuration is and how the extra dimensions are compactified and the space-time is collapsing, when it goes through the quantum process that leads to a bounce, you may have quantum fluctuations in the way that compactification is happening, and the physical characteristics of the universe that it's expanding may be slightly different from the physical characteristics of the universe where you had the collapse. And if this were true, then you have a way of having cosmological natural selection in the sense that for certain choices of the physical constants, you will never form black holes. And for other choices of the physical constants, you might optimally form black holes. So why would you never form a black hole? I mean, suppose that the weak interaction was very weak. Then one of the things that might happen is that the neutrons would live long at the start of the universe. And then you would have time, instead of the 3-minute window that you have for forming light nuclei, you would have a very long time, and you would basically form all of helium-4. If you had that, it turns out that you won't have stellar fusion processes happen the same way that they normally do, and you'll end up not forming stars. Or if gravitation was a little bit weaker, you might not collapse into stars to form fusion. The strong interaction will be. So there's lots of things that if you tweaked a little bit, you would live in a universe where black holes cannot form. But if, in fact, you are in this strange multiverse where universes are formed inside of black holes, then those universes where you have the physical constants where a black hole is most likely to form, you would expect to have black holes, and within those, you would expect to have universes form. And since they start from a universe that can form black holes, Their physical characteristics will be close to universes that can form black holes. Those that are very optimal to form black holes after they sort of are created are likely to form more black holes and give you more universes. So what this really means is if you were to have somehow a universe spring into existence, which, and what the star is to this picture, who knows, but if you were to have the star and you have a universe that can create a black hole, then it will create a universe that's likely to create black holes, and eventually the constants will sort of migrate into the region where you are most likely to have universes form from universes that are optimal for forming black holes. So he then argues that if we look carefully at the physical constants that we have in our universe, if this model of the multiverse were real, then we should have constants of nature that are basically optimal for making black holes. And in principle, that is something people can explore, try to understand. And people do. I mean, I have read quotes from highly reputable astrophysicists. One who says, it's clearly true that they're optimal for it, and others say, well, it's not at all. So I don't think it's ever actually going to be resolved, but in principle, it is falsifiable in the sense that if we now look at the physical constants in our universe and we realize that they were very far from being optimal to form black holes, it would basically then kill that multiverse theory, because within that theory, we should be close to optimal. So that one, at least, is a falsifiable version of a multiple universe. The strangest multiverse that we've talked about is Tegmark's mathematical universe hypothesis, where what he says is, if you are a believer in a theory of everything, and if you are a believer that such a theory of everything can exist. So that's almost equivalent to saying, you know, you're a believer that mathematics isn't invented, but it's discovered. So there is sort of this great mathematical theory of everything that's out there. First of all, he says it has to be mathematics, because any other way of trying to describe something is open to, it has ambiguities, it's open to discussion. So we can't use English because English has lots of words that are ambiguous. We can't use music because it means something different to everybody. Maybe it's some other thing that we don't know anything about, but what he argues is mathematics fits what you need to create a theory of everything, because when you set up a mathematical system, you set up a series of rules, and it just follows those rules, whatever they happen to be. And I think unless you've done, you know, math major-ish sort of stuff, you don't realize how sort of odd math is, in the sense that we're used to our algebra, but you can invent algebras that have different rules, and you can make them self-consistent, and you can follow what happens out of those rules. And this is the kind of crap that mathematicians do. And it's interesting, it's fun, but what he says is that if you're going to have a theory of everything, because it has to be unambiguous, it will have to be mathematics. And if you have a mathematical theory of everything, it has to describe everything, which basically means there has to be a correspondence between this mathematical theory and every aspect of reality that you see. And he then invokes this mathematical definition, which says if you have a one-to-one correspondence between this theory and that theory, and there is an established one-to-one mapping, then it is a way of proving that this theory and that theory are equivalent. And so he argues you have to have this one-to-one mapping between the mathematical theory of everything and our universe. Therefore, our universe is mathematics, is basically what he said. So that's pretty out there. But then he takes it one step further, which is, if you argue that any complete self-consistent mathematical theory corresponds to a universe, why this universe, or why that mathematics? So he then argues that that can't be special, so that any complete self-consistent mathematical theory should correspond to the universe, basically. So now everything's crazy, because then it means that even physics as we know it and every other aspect of what we think of as our universe is basically up for grabs, because you can invent any weird thing you want so long as it sort of fits this mathematical theory. So that's about as abstract as you can get. Tegmark calls that his level 4 multiverse. So that's sort of the most extreme thing. There's one of the interesting points that I wanted to make after all this is that it may not be, if you were to swallow any of these, or let us assume for a moment that some of these are possible, they are not mutually exclusive. So if inflation is true, you probably have a type 1 multiverse where you have space that's like ours, which is much greater in extent than we will ever be causally connected to. That could be a bubble inside an inflating matrix where you have other universes where the space is even different. And both of those things could be true at the same time. So that means Tegmark, you know, type 1 and type 2 universes, multiverses, could be, in fact, true at the same time. At the same time, you could have quantum mechanics operational in any of these realities, and that's another multiverse that's sort of conceptually rather different. So it may not be, do we live in a multiverse, but it could well be, how many different types of multiple universe do we actually live in? Yeah?
Is it possible to prove we can live in a multiverse, that the idea eventually, even what we know, there not being some sort of multiverse becomes equally as absurd in the future?
I think inflation borders on that. If you have inflation, I don't know how you avoid a multiple universe.
Right.
Okay. So, I mean, that's me, and maybe somebody will figure out a way in which you can do it. And inflation's only some years old. So my guess is this is a kind of crazy idea that will continue. Maybe in 30 years, somebody will prove some strange uniqueness theorem that, you know, shows that we... And if a string theorist comes along who truly somehow solves for the optimal configuration of space-time and can somehow make an argument as to why all configurations you might have to collapse into this one, then maybe you've got an argument as to, you know, some sort of uniqueness thing. I mean, I don't know. There is one model out there cosmologically that sort of fits most of the data. It's open whether it fits this new bicep data or not. But it doesn't require inflation. It's a different sort of multiverse. It's the one where you have these three-dimensional, the three brains colliding in bulk. I mean, it's pretty out there, but it sort of fits the data. So my guess is this will be a continually evolving thing, but right now, the thing is, inflation is not just pulled out of thin air. There's a lot of scientific data that now really sort of supports this picture, so... I don't know. At any rate, what I wanted to do, I was thinking about, I knew this was going to be a little bit short, and so I was thinking about filling the time talking to you guys about neutrinos, that I think, given the state of the projectors, we'll pass on that. So let me at least tell a short story which I probably put in my book, unfortunately. If you read it, you probably got it. But I love this quote. There's a guy named Steven Weinberg who's now at the University of Texas. And he's a very famous physicist, Nobel Prize winner, for basically being one of those physicists who came up with the standard model of particle physics. So the Higgs mechanism you may have heard a lot about, and you have one of the players in inventing the Higgs mechanism here, that basically was inventing a mathematical mechanism that was then used by Weinberg and a couple of other guys to cobble together what we call the standard model of particle physics, where they mathematically unified the electromagnetic and the weak interactions. And so this model seems to be what nature fits. So he won the Nobel Prize. But at some point, somebody asked him whether or not he believed in the multiverse. And he related that he had just read a book by another physicist called named Martin Rees. And Rees had said he had enough confidence in the multiverse to bet his dog's life on it. Andre Linde, who actually, if you read some of the stuff for... If you read the stuff on inflation, Andre Linde is one of the... He's a physicist at Stanford, one of the guys who invented inflation. So he's also a very famous cosmologist and everything. Andre Linde said he had enough confidence to bet his own life on the multiverse. And so Weinberg was giving a talk about this and relating the story. And Weinberg says, "As for me, I have just enough confidence about the multiverse to bet the lives of both Andre Linde and Martin Rees's dog." So you have all different takes on it. So I don't know whether you should believe in it or not. That's a religious thing, I guess. But I hope now you have a feeling for why people actually talk about it in a serious way. And I probably mentioned this already. If I go to a faculty meeting over in physics and the multiverse comes up, you get all the old-timers, you know, looking at you like, "What, nuts?" and everything. And the young-timers, too. It's not something a lot of physicists have thought a lot about. But one of the messages I wanted to bring to you, which actually, if I say it in the faculty meeting, it causes people to like, "Really?" And that is, if you have inflation, the multiverse is probably there, at least in terms of everything we know now. And inflation is something that most of the physicists in the room take very seriously because there's a lot of data that supports it. The cosmology is now on a pretty reasonable footing. So when you put it that way, then you start getting a few raised eyebrows. So I think that's why when the BICEP results were released, you read some of those articles, there's a huge amount of excitement going on. Because the whole idea of inflation is something that it's been there, it fixes problems, but really? I mean, do you really believe that? And now you actually have data that we can't explain in another way, at least not yet. So it's very exciting. And then when you carry it a step further, you get all these other implications. Because it basically implies quantum gravity, it implies the existence of gravitational waves, and it implies the existence of the universe. So pretty strange stuff. Yes?
I mean, I'm curious about the way in which this keeps sort of popping up in really different parts of the field. And I wonder if that's partially because that's just where the math goes, and or if it's it's just an interesting enough implication that it's sort of more fun or more interesting to sort of think of focus on the parts of these theories that lead to that particular question.
The quantum mechanics and the cosmology largely come from totally different places. However, I did I did read something, it's been a while, and I didn't pursue it deeply at the time. But I think basically both of them say that anything that can happen will happen, sort of. And I think since they're both so all-encompassing in that way, they turn out to be equivalent. So, I mean, at some point I picked up that idea, and so it had to do with something I was reading, but I don't think I pursued it deeply at that time. But I think you might be able to argue that there's effectively an equivalence between these two pictures, which has a little bit to say. I don't know. Okay? Well, I'm not going to fight the projector, so I'm done. Thank you all. As for how things will finish up here, I think I'm going to extract your last journal and send it out to each of you for ranking. I will extract the rankings for the journals. I probably will not bother extracting the comments this time, just because that adds a lot of time for me, and the feedback is only marginal use to you at this point. But I'll let you know what the rankings were, and then I'm going through and reading them all, and also sort of ranking myself to try to basically... I have to think about how seriously to take your rankings versus my rankings. In some cases, I have examples where somebody is ranked very high, but they completely missed the point of the reading, actually. And so I have to think a little bit about how to handle it, and vice versa. Okay, I've seen people rank low for really sort of wrong reasons. So a lot of the motivation for having to do the ranking was to sort of really look and see what other people were thinking, as well as to give me feedback. So I'm not saying I'm going to discount your rankings, because I'm not, but I have to figure out. What I haven't done is I've looked at your rankings, so I have some idea that a lot of the time it's pretty reasonable, and some of the time it's just way off. And part of that's also statistics, because, you know, sometimes you've only had one or two people rank, and other times you have eight, and so I've tried to even that out every time, but it really just depends on your hands in the rankings. So if you have one person rank you and they happen to like it or not, and maybe they did the reading or maybe they didn't, you know, so it's a little hard to say. So I have to do a reality check on the ranking as we go. But I'll try to do some reasonable amalgam of that. My intent is to try to be generous with the grading, because all I really want is the evidence that you have participated and done a lot of the reading and done, you know, the writing and thought about. That's really all I'm really after. So, any rate, we'll see what happens. What I will do is tell you what I tried to do. I'll send an email out to you, and I'll put whatever information I can in Blackboard so you can see what you got, and I'll tell you what I did. And then if you have any issues, feel free to email me, and we'll try to work it out. So, okay? Any questions from you guys? Any worries, concerns? Okay, well, I enjoyed you as a class. I enjoyed the first part more because I was able to get more out of you. It's hard to get a lot out of a class when you're talking about some of this really weird crap. But, you know, it's not exactly open to too many opinions or conversation. So, okay. Have a good one.